Okay, I suppose this is good enough. I will get started. I am here, of course, to talk about Intermezzo, which is the distributed file system prototype. We've been working on it for about 7 months now, Dr. Peter Brahm and I at Carnegie Mellon. And so I sort of left Carnegie Mellon to keep doing this thing. It started out as an undergraduate research project and sort of became something more. First off, I'd like to sort of give a brief overview of what they're supposed to do, ideally. The whole core is obviously to make remote files act as if they're local, so that your applications can seamlessly use these remote objects without even realizing it. It's even better if it's done well, so that you can do file sharing between different people in your group. Otherwise, if you had to change a document and then put it up for FTP every time you change it so the rest of your group would have it, that would really suck. So you don't want to do that. For those of you that saw Nat's talk, there's also the laptop-desktop problem, which some of them solve and some of them don't. I want to be able to take my laptop, have all my files on it, disconnect it, take it on the train, change things, and come back, and I want everything to just be the same when I'm done. And so some people do that, and it's really nice to have a file system to let you do it. There's some examples, some good examples and some not-so-good examples. NFS you can get for just about any operating system now, but it doesn't do a lot of the things that some of the more advanced file systems do, and so you don't get all the features. AFS was also started at CMU 10 or 15 years ago, but right now it's not open source, and it's really, really, really expensive. And there are alternatives like Arla, but I'm not sure they're quite there yet, and there's no real server available. Coda was also born from CMU about 10 years ago, and it is open source. As far as I know, it's all GPL. There's MT versions, Linux versions, BSD versions, but it's really, really complicated. It's a threaded model. It's over 500,000 lines of code, and there's really only 4 or 5 people in the world that really, really, really understand it well enough to fix the problems in a timely fashion. So you get into problems with complexity. Intermezzo started as ideally to just redo Coda, but do it well. And along the way, we've done some features that don't exist in Coda, and we've improved some of them. But overall, we try to keep it really, really simple. And right now, it's I think it's 2,500 lines of kernel code and about 7,000 lines of Perl. And there's we stayed away from the nasty Perl one-liners. And so we tried to keep it relatively clean. We used some outside packages, and it's overall pretty intelligible, I think. NFS, though I guess it's technically a distributed file system, doesn't really perform. You can't guarantee up-to-date files. If you do things in the right order, there's a 2 or 3 second window where you can look at a file on this machine, change it over here, look at it again, and you'll see old data. And so that's not so very good. But beyond that 2 or 3 second window, it doesn't cache accesses. So if you load up a file, and then a minute later you load it up again, it's going to pull it back down the wire, and that's no good. There's no disconnected operation at all. So if I want to take my laptop on the train, I have to copy it all to local disk, and then copy them all back onto the NFS store when I get back. And so that doesn't work so well. Consequently, there's no conflict resolution. NFS uses regular Unix file sharing semantics, so as soon as I do a write, it's propagated across. If two people do 2 writes at the same time, anything could happen. You're not really sure. Because there's no disconnected operation, there's no conflict between a laptop that's not on the network and a desktop that is. It's just not there. There's no server replication. So there's no really easy way to have a bunch of NFS servers and load balance across them and make sure everything stays up to date. AFS Code and Intermezzo are a bit more thought through. They're a bit more modern in terms of file systems. They all guarantee no stale data. They use a system of callbacks and permits that I'll get into a little bit later to ensure that whatever copy you have in your cache is valid or you pull down a new one. There's read and write back caching so that it keeps a cache on your local disk for files that you've already read. And as you modify files, it lazily propagates them back to the server. Coda and Intermezzo can disconnect. I can take my laptop on the road with me, and I'm more or less guaranteed that I can have all my files that I would have on my desktop, and when I plug back in, they'll all reintegrate back to the server. Consequently, they can resolve conflicts, so if I change a file here now, and somebody else changes one on the network, it'll let me know when I try to reintegrate that there's been a conflict, and a window can pop up and say, which one do you want to keep? Do you want to run edif on them? However you want to do it, it's up to you. And finally, they support multiple servers. So you can have a whole cluster full of load balancing servers, and clients will automatically grab one and make some effort at being relatively consistent with spreading out the accesses. Our design is relatively simple. There's two major parts. There's a kernel-level file systems driver, which is more or less a wrapper that intercepts VFS calls. And so we maintain our cache on a local native file system. You could put your cache on ext2. You could put it on XFS. You could put it on NTFS. You could put it on whatever you want. And our wrapper just intercepts the VFS calls and does what's necessary. It sends up calls, which are more or less just requests to the user-level cache manager. And right now that's implemented in Perl. I'll get into why a little bit later and what the future is for it. And by using this native file system as a cache, we avoid the complications of writing a whole fully featured file system. Both AFS and Coda both implemented their own file systems. And it's a big source of bugs. It's very complex. There's race conditions, and there's a lot of things to think about. And by avoiding that and pushing it under the rug, we avoid a huge source of problems, and it made development a lot faster. We use asynchronous protocols. Coda, especially, and NFS is totally synchronous, and Coda is mostly synchronous. So you'll immediately see a huge benefit by lazily propagating your changes back to the server instead of waiting for a confirmation on every change you make. We use callbacks and permits that I mentioned before. Callbacks are issued when you download data, and so they guarantee that your data is fresh. And permits execute some sort of concurrency control to make sure that you don't get conflicts while everybody's connected to the network. If your laptop is connected and your desktop is connected, you're virtually guaranteed not to have conflicts. There are some subtle timing issues where you can force conflicts, but it's pretty rare. And finally, file versioning. Every file has a version associated with it, so that you can use that to recover file systems after a crash. You could use it to recover file systems when you reconnect to the network. And you can use them to detect conflicts. If versions are out of sync, then you immediately know you have a conflict. We had some requirements. As we were brainstorming, we really wanted to make this well thought. And so we wanted to certainly reuse available technology already. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel as much as possible. So we wanted to use things like rsync. If we wanted to get huge volumes in sync quickly, rsync's not a bad idea. We wanted to use SSL and SSH for security at some point. Just provide nice hooks for those. TCP. Coda, when it started 10 or 15 years ago, it was a good idea to use UDP. TCP wasn't quite as far along as it is now. Now there's really no reason to do all the things that TCP does on our own. And of course, the native file systems that I mentioned before. We must have disconnected operation. There's really no point in making a distributed file system right now that doesn't support it, because it really limits you. Server replication, obviously. Write-back caching, very important. Coda has two modes. You can use write-back caching, or you can turn it off. And we saw no need to ever turn it off. And we wanted to make everything very, very symmetric. In order to keep it simple, we wanted to have all of our mechanisms go two-way. So when you fetch a file from the server, it's exactly the same mechanism as sending changes back, and vice versa. So that was a really big, important feature for us. I'd like to start with the kernel code. Like I said before, it's a wrapper on file systems. And as these requests come in, the kernel maintains attributes for all of its cached files. So at any point, if there's a cache hit, it knows immediately if it has the attributes of the file, the data, or both. It also knows things like if this mount point is the root of a volume. It knows whether or not this entire volume is up to date, and things like that. When you mount, you give a special flag with the volume name, but more importantly, the file system type. And by telling it that, it remembers all of the underlying VFS operations that you would normally call just accessing that file system directly. And since it knows that, it allows our cache manager direct access to the file system. So the applications don't really touch the file system. For the most part, it's the cache manager that touches the file system for it. It intercepts VFS requests from applications. So if you do a read, Presto intercepts it and sends a request down to our cache manager, does some fuddling, and eventually returns back to the application. And finally, it journals file system changes. Since we lazily propagate them back, we create a page in memory, and we just fill these with journal instructions. When the page is full, we ship it down to the cache manager and lazily propagate them back to the server. Here's some pseudocode for open. This is the type of thing that you'd see in Presto. It's a little bit less convoluted, but for the most part, things are more or less this simple. If you don't have the data for this particular inode, and you're not the cache manager, then you send a request down to the cache manager. You do an upcall. When that's finished, you execute the real VFS requests, assuming there are no errors at any point, and you simply return that to your application, and that's all it takes. So a great deal of Lento code is really just wrapper functions like that. There are some subtle race conditions we had to deal with at certain points, and there, you know, there's journaling code beside that, but it's really quite simple. When somebody actually updates the file system, the request, like every other request, is intercepted by Presto, and what is called a permit is acquired. And the rules for permits are that only one system can ever have a permit for a particular file or a particular directory or the volume granularity, however you want to define it. And so as long as everybody's connected to the network, you're guaranteed to not see conflicts. And so that's what permits do. The updates, like I said before, are stuck in a kernel page. And when that page is full, another upcall, a journaling upcall, is given back to Lento, and this page is shipped along. And then the kernel forgets about it. When Lento has the data, it can be committed to disk in case of a crash, or just propagated back to the server, or whatever you like. And finally, they're propagated back to the server, and the server forwards them on to other clients, or to replicated servers, or to whoever has expressed a need to have updated data immediately. If you haven't expressed that need, you won't get this new data until you request it. But if you want the data, it will be shipped to you automatically. Any conflicts are resolved on the client side. So that if you have a conflict, if I plug my laptop back in and I have conflicting files, it won't affect the rest of the network until I resolve those conflicts. So anybody else will see the old versions. When I finally decided what I want to do with the files, then they're reintegrated and everybody else can see them. That process of sending back changes are called backfetches. Like I said before, it's a symmetric process with fetching the file in the first place, and it's executed as part of the reintegration process that I'll talk about a little later. This diagram is pretty revealing, and so I think it's useful to look at it. Applications come in through the VFS layer, or the application calls, rather, into the file system come in through the VFS layer. They're intercepted by Presto. If the data is, in fact, already fresh, we have a cached version that exists. It goes straight down the local file system and returns, and you're done. That's the fast path. That's the normal path. Everything after the first access is at approximately local file system. If the data is not in fact fresh, then it sends an upcall up to Lento, which will talk to other Lentos, which would be the servers, or maybe whoever has the permit for this to get the new version of the file, or whatever that might entail, or fetches the file, puts it on a local file system, and then finally returns to Presto, which tells the application. If this happens to be an update, then it'll go into the kernel update journal, and that finally gets filled up, Presto automatically ships back to Lento, and it's sent back to the server. Our protocols are more or less simple. There's four or five things that sort of make up the entirety of Intermezzo. We have callbacks, which don't really exist as their own function. They're automatically generated when you grab a new file. So when you're shipped data, you're assumed to have a callback. When somebody else modifies the file, the server maintains a list of stateful connections, people that have these callbacks for certain files, certain volumes, directories, whatever granularity you want to define. And these callbacks are broken by sending a single request to every client and then collecting all the replies. So instead of creating 50 sessions, you create one session which sends 50 commands and requests and then cleans out all the sessions that never replied. There are permits that I described before, issued to one client at a time, broken when somebody else modifies data. And breaking a permit forces reintegration. So if I ask you to break your permit, you're forced at that time to give me back any changes you have. If you don't give them back after a certain amount of time, you're not behaving and you're thrown off the cluster. And you have to begin by reconnecting, establishing your file system validity, and doing all of those checks. There's the validate call, which validates cached objects when you come back up from a crash, when you reconnect to the network, anything like that that involves getting yourself back in sync with the servers goes through validate. since our first target for Intermezzo was for things like failover web servers, things that have a lot of read access and not so much write access and probably not as many conflicts, we decided to just use a scheme based on M time and size. CODA uses a very complicated algorithm that generates version vectors. We might do that at some point. Right now, it doesn't seem like a big deal. We haven't seen a lot of problems with our M time and size based scheme, so no need to really modify it now. And finally, reintegrate. And reintegrate is arguably the most complicated thing the file system will ever do. It involves shipping back that modification log to the server, and then the server executes things one by one in the same order that they were executed on the client. Eventually, it might say, here is a file that the client changed. I now need to request all of the changes that file made or that client made before I can continue. So then it sends a request to the client, reintegrates the file, and then continues down the log. So this can take a long time. Some of the file systems, like the new Windows and Telemirror file system, just dictate that everybody closes their files. So while it's reintegrating, if your file is open, it makes no guarantees for you. We try to avoid this. We try to make it as friendly to the applications as possible, because it really sucks if every time you wanted to reintegrate, you had to close down Emacs. That's not really great. The journal page is sent to the server. File system modified. Yes, I went through this. Okay. The update forwarding that I mentioned before, so that it sends these modification logs to other servers, is exactly the same as reintegrate. It's another example of the symmetry in our protocols, so that we reused all of the code we wrote the first time for update forwarding. And I mentioned conflicts handled in the clients. The cache manager and file server is written in Perl. And back in January, when Peter proposed this, I thought it was really pretty loony, because I didn't like Perl. I had only really ever used Perl 4. And so he decided that, well, we're going to do Perl because it's a nice thing, and I argued and I lost. But now I really like it, and for a few good reasons. There's a lot of good tools. CPAN is just full of really good tools. And when we started this project, we didn't really want to think about network stacks, and we didn't really want to think about databasing, and so we just grabbed some packages and used those for the time being. So we were able to get a core of the file system built right away without worrying about the cruft. Secondly is general development speed. I can write Perl that would take me vastly many lines of C to come up with, because Perl has built-in hash tables and lists and arrays and garbage collection and all of these things that make my life very, very easy. And rewritability. We've rewritten the core of Intermezzo 4 times. We've written the network layer 6 times. And I don't think we would have ever done that if we'd had a single line of C. It's just a lot more work. And so Perl made things a whole lot better. We used the Perl object environment, dubbed POE, which generically builds a single-threaded state machine. And it's relatively simple. It's got a set of wheels and filters that I'll talk about a little later. But the nice part about it is it can be duplicated without too much effort in C, so we can keep our same programming model when we eventually make the transition to C without sitting down and going back to the whiteboard and thinking about this all over again. It took us a long time to arrive at an event-driven model, and we'd really like to stick with it. It's totally asynchronous. All of the I/O is asynchronous. Nothing ever blocks. We make a request down to these wheels and filters, which are the mechanism for doing I/O. They're POE's names for them. And they will eventually respond with some sort of callback, some sort of completion that lets us know that here's some data that I got from the buffer, or this packet just came in, here's a request for you to process. Anything like that is all taken care of through callbacks and asynchronous I/O. Every new request that comes in generates a POE session, which is not a thread, but they do have process-like relationships to one another. That I'll get into, I think, on my next slide. POE made things a lot easier. The first 3 or 4 times we tried this, we managed state ourselves, and we had some very complicated functions that tried to make sure they were in the right state and make sure they got to the right state along the way, and no one was ever really sure how you got from A to B, and in the end, it just was a whole mess, and we decided to scrap it and start over. Unlike CODA, we decided against threads. And threads are really nice, I guess, if you have a multiprocessor machine, but there's no reason you couldn't just run two versions of the cache manager to serve two separate volumes. That's not a big deal. It'll work fine. But threads, as Zach will tell you tomorrow, are really, really hard. And it's hard to get event-driven stuff right, but it's a lot harder to get threaded event-driven stuff right. And we did not even want to touch that. Sessions all have heaps for local data that are immediately garbage collected when the session goes away, so we don't have to worry about stuff like that. They all contain a certain amount of state and a certain amount of event handlers. And in some ways, the event handlers have an implied state. If you're in this event handler, you know what you're doing. Otherwise, you really shouldn't be here. So some state we sort of sweep under the rug by virtue of knowing that if we're in a specific subroutine, we're doing the right thing. They receive events from a PoE kernel, which is responsible for redirecting these events from session to session. Sessions can post events to other events. They can get events posted from wheels and filters that I talked about before. But they do really have a process-style relationship. They have their own metadata. They are really separate entities that can be created and destroyed at will without affecting others. And we have a concept of volumes. Volumes are not like partitions. You would not really want a 40 gigabyte volume. It would not really do what you want. They're intended to be small, perhaps like the granularity of a home directory. So one cache manager would serve as many volumes as you want, but they're intended to be relatively small. They have their own internal metadata, so they know if they're up to date. They know what server they belong on. They have a unique identifier for each volume, things like that. And you can store a volume on one or more servers, thereby generating some sort of server replication from which you can get updated data from anywhere and do things like load balancing. A sample PoE session. It consists mostly of Perl subroutines that are sort of embedded in this call. And the new PoE session itself is overloaded, but that's not really important, I guess. Each one of these corresponds to an event. You have the init event, the attribute arrived event, the new file fetch and complete, and whatever else more you might have. You might have handle error, handle connection error, handle file system error. Whatever errors you wanted to separately handle, you can do that however you like. And so a generic session would go something like this. It starts up. It's called init or start. If it already has the attributes, then it goes ahead and just does a new file fetch. If it doesn't have the attributes, then it requests those separately. And then it will receive a callback when those are finished with attr arrived. If the state is successful, then we post a new file fetch and continue on like we would have if we'd already had the attributes. Otherwise, we explode, we send some sort of error, we propagate it back up the chain, we disconnect from the server, whatever seems appropriate based on the error that we receive. There's tables of errors and sort of an internal understanding of if this is a connection error, you really don't have any choice but to throw away your data and try again. If this is just a file not found, then you can mark a negative entry in the cache and keep going. A new file fetch would call some sort of function, do file fetch, and again, just be given an event callback when it's finished. In that way, it's relatively easy to plug in a new session, like do file fetch could call something that called rsync for gigantic files. Or however you want to do bulk transfer, it's really up to you. You can plug things in and take things out. It's not a big deal. And then finally, when do file fetch is done, it'll call complete. It will reply to the kernel so that your application gets the message that you're finished. It will handle any other queues. Maybe some other session requested this file at the same time. We don't want to fetch it twice, so just handle that queue. And finally explode successfully, and the session will go away. So they're really intended to be small, lightweight, self-contained, individual request sessions so that you don't have a lot of overhead for a single request. There are a pile of sessions that we don't ever garbage collect that we expect to live through the entire duration of a particular cache manager. They are the request dispatcher, which only ever exists once. And when request packets come in from the network or an upcall comes up from the kernel, this session is responsible for generating other sessions of the appropriate type with the appropriate arguments that know more or less what they're supposed to do. There are connectors. Every server has an associated connector. And that connector is responsible for getting a connection to the server, making sure it's still valid, if necessary, sending pings across to let the other side know that it's still alive. It's responsible for cleaning up if the connection were to go down for any reason. It's responsible for letting other sessions know that their connection has suddenly gone away. And so sessions register with a connection, and when they're finished, they are notified. Acceptors are the server side. They handle incoming connections, and they do more or less the same thing as connectors. And monitors make sure the connections stay alive. We had some problems with PoE. I don't know if anybody's used it before, but PoE doesn't always let you know when there's been an error. And so sometimes connections would go away. I'd unplug my Ethernet, and not until 45 minutes later when I typed LF would I be notified that my server was gone. And so that was sort of suboptimal. Network packets. Our networking layer is pretty simple. We have six basic packet types, and they seem to serve all of our general needs. We don't, in fact, even use the sixth type. Messages are intended to be like requests, but they don't expect a reply, and they're just sort of generic informational things. We could use messages to break callbacks, for example, except that we really do want a reply. We want to know that you're still alive, that you've acknowledged our request, and that you've cleaned out your cache. Requests are, I mean, that there is no real client and server relationship other than policy. And so a request could easily come from the server to the client. But it's easier to think of a request as becoming its own client-server relationship. When I issue a request, I become, for this session, a client, and you are the server. And it's just a good way of thinking of it. When you have big requests, like I want to fetch these 10 files, you might send three different packets. If for whatever reason these files are really huge and you want to send three different packets, at the end you would send an end of request. I'm finished. This is all I'm going to send. Please begin sending me these files. Replies go in the opposite direction. They usually have an error code. They might also have some metadata. They might have important information based on what you're trying to do with this particular request. We guarantee that for every reply there's at least one request. So sending an unrequested reply will make your connection explode. Data also requires a request. So if I were to do a fetch file, I would send a request, I would receive a reply, and then I would receive a lot of data packets. At the end of all that, I would receive an end of data packet, and that's self-explanatory. We have ACTs, asynchronous completion tokens, which were who came up with these? These were first used by, there's a C++ toolkit, whose name I forget, that popularized ACTs. And in a nutshell, it gets packets to the right session. So when I send a request, an ACT is generated with my session, and it's sort of nicely tied together in a hash table. Nothing complicated. When I get a reply, it's looked up and given to the right session. Here's another one of my pretty displays. And it displays the path of an up call. So what happens when a client requests a file? This is more or less the path through the code that it takes. The got up call goes into the rec dispatcher, which will start up a new up call session. And any up call session, when it's created, is associated with a server object because it has to know where to get files. That makes sense. So it notifies the connector, who adds it to its list of client sessions. If it's not already connected, then it creates a connection, which at some point will either respond with a got wheel, which means it succeeded, it's connected, we're ready for data, or a got error. I couldn't connect, you're not on the network, the server doesn't exist, whatever. The connector, if it got an error, will immediately propagate it back, and you're done. If the kernel can't get its file, I'm sorry. Otherwise, it will respond with a got connection. The upcall session then sends a request directly using the connection. It's the connector is no longer needed. It skips it, and it goes straight to the connection. It'll receive replies, data, whatever it takes. When it's finished, it eventually replies to the kernel and then self-destructs. It's no longer needed. The session was self-contained, and it goes away. Similarly, this is what happens on the server side of this type of request. If this is a new connection being made, the acceptor also creates a connection. another good example of the symmetry of these protocols. It just brings in a request. The connection receives this request, and it sends it back to this request session, which is then created by the rec dispatcher and done everything that was said before, which will send replies and data and whatnot. It could even send other requests for things like reintegration. This is not uncommon. It'll also send requests and receive replies. And so the server-client model sort of gets muddled in that type of sense. Eventually, in the end, it has to send an end of data or an end of request or something to indicate that it really is finished, and then it self-destructs. We have a bunch of tables that sort of just keep track of generic things. We have things like clients, and client tables are stored on the server. Unlike NFS, Intermezzo is very, very stateful. It maintains a whole lot of state. It knows which callbacks you have. It knows which permits you have. It knows which volumes you are allowed to read. It maintains all sorts of information, where you're coming from, what your system ID is. All of that sort of stuff goes in the clients. Server records are stored, consequently, on the client side. They contain an address, a port, which volumes go there, what was the last record I sent to this server, does the server have any replicators, things of that nature. Volumes are unique to a particular file system holding location. So when you start up Lento, you have a volume database that designates /ISO as an Intermezzo volume. And from that point on, all of those requests are handled by the session manager. And these volumes keep track of all the data that goes through them. A cluster is defined as a group of computers that share a same volume database, a similar volume database. And so, in theory, if everybody has all the same volume database, everybody can see exactly the same files in exactly the same location, and so on and so forth. There's the file system database, which we had originally, and now we've gotten rid of, and we might put back. What it is, basically, is it would be the place where you would store the version vectors. It would be the place where you would store things like the last reintegrated record, the last place that I reintegrated this file, perhaps. Who is currently responsible for this file? Things of that nature. Unfortunately, the reason we got rid of it for the time being is that recovery of the file system database is excruciatingly difficult, because you have to write this file system database to a file on local disk periodically, so that if you crash, you are available to it's available to be recovered. However, you're not really sure, did my last write hit the file? Did I get half of a write on the disk? Did it not fully update? Or perhaps the inode's out of sync, but the data is new? Similarly, the data in the file system database itself might be incorrect. I might have written a file to my Intermezzo volume, but it didn't quite make it to the FSDB yet. Or vice versa, the FSDB says it's new, but the data's really old. And so you get into a lot of tricky race conditions here. You get into cases where you have to examine 5, 6, 7, 8 different cases just to recover your FSDB. And it was really sort of a non-trivial endeavor we didn't really want to dive into just yet. So we got rid of it. This is more or less what happens with the tables on startup. So when you start up a bootstrap session, which exists only for the amount of time that it takes to start up the server, is created. And that parses any arguments you give on the command line. It starts up the server database, the volume database. It reads your volume database from disk. It puts them in these nice tables very prettily. It sets up the file system database if we ever put it back. It sets up the PS dev, which is the mode for talking to the kernel. It has a device, dev presto. It starts up acceptor sessions if it's a server. It starts up dispatcher sessions for both. It starts up server semantics, which I'll get into in just a little bit. And then it passes off control to PoE, and it's done. The server semantic engine is our self-contained little bundle of semantics. Our idea here was not only to make a nice file system, but also something that could be changed at will into whatever file system you wanted. So in that sense, it's sort of an attractive research vehicle. All of our semantics are stored in a single Perl file, or whatever you want in the future. And so if you decide that you don't want to break permits on write, but rather, say, on close, you can make that change there, no problem. If you decide that you don't necessarily want to have callbacks on a volume level, but rather on a directory level or on a file granularity, you can do that there. All other really tricky semantic issues, we've tried to keep defined in that file. And we're not very happy with the way we've done that yet, but we're trying to slowly move all of our things over into server semantics that really depend on being there. It's really important to note that we've leaned on a lot of prior work. As you may or may not know, Peter Brom, that I've worked very closely with, was on the CODA project for 3 or 4 years. And he, last December, with Michael Callahan, decided to start this file system, and then he sort of railroaded me into it in January. But we've had a lot of discussions, even since then, with other members of the CODA project, and they've been really very helpful. A lot of tricks and race conditions that they figured out at one point have really helped us now. It saved a lot of effort, a lot of time. CMU was gracious enough to keep us from having to rewrite all this code. Originally, I wrote this for credit, in fact, for a research project. And if they hadn't allowed us to GPL it, then I would have had to sit down and rewrite all of that code again. And so all that kernel code, which we really have only rewritten once, would have had to be done again. Stellius Computing is who currently pays me to do this. And it's Peter's company, and we're trying very hard to make something that's really viable for everybody really pretty quickly. And if I wasn't being paid to do it, I wouldn't have nearly as much time, and the last 8 weeks wouldn't have gone nearly so well. And Seagate, though they haven't really had a hand in Intermezzo yet, they did pay for my trip here, and that means there's more money for you guys to have parties. So you should thank them as well. Here's all the pertinent information. We released 0.002, which, in fact, despite its version number, is really quite good. It does disconnected operation in a lot of cases. So, I mean, there's a couple times where if you unplug it at just the right place, you'll get it to fall over. But if you do it when it's quiet and then you do make BZ image, it'll go fine. When you plug it back in, it'll all go back to the server, and it works great. It does update forwarding and server replication so that if you have two servers that want to load balance, it just works. It requires 229. There were some bugs that we had to fix, and it requires 229. 2.3 has a lot of file system changes, as some of you know. We have a unified page cache now, and that will take some more effort to get going, so I'm afraid we don't support that yet. Sorry. Everything you need is on the web page. There's a lot of white papers. There's some past talks that have been given. All of our source code there. There's a lot of instructions, mailing lists, anything you really need. If you have particular questions, that address goes to all three of us. And so that's your most likely bet to get something answered. We're happy to answer feedback. We hope it works for you. And we do recommend, however, that you don't put necessarily really critical data on it just yet. So it's worth noting, however, that this talk was given entirely from a disconnected Intermezzo share, which is running over in this window. And if we display the mount items, we have, in fact, mounted an Intermezzo share on /ISO, for which the talk was given. And I thought it worked pretty well. So that's a small testament to its usability. Questions? Chris?
One is, how are you handling tokens for identity for individual users, hosts?
Oh, okay. All right.
The second one is related. What are you using for attributes? Are you limited to attributes that are on the file system currently? Can you expand it? I'm really thinking, how are you doing ACLs in the future?
Yes. Right. I'll answer your second one first. The FSDB is really good for extra metadata. And because we don't really have an FSDB right now, and it's because we want to use native file systems, we can't really just throw in metadata. It doesn't work that way, right. Obviously. So when the FSDB is back, and there is reason to believe that it will, in fact, be back, then there's no reason why you couldn't add your own ACL metadata and track them yourself. And it would be relatively easy to do your own permission checking right there. As for users, We haven't really decided that point yet. We have a concept of UUIDs, which are unique UIDs. We have a concept of server ID. And though our client and our server are one executable, and they're very symmetric, there's no real difference aside from policy. So the server knows not to trust clients, but aside from that, if you authenticate and you build your own authentication mechanism, there's nothing to say that it won't happily tie in. I don't know if...
Well, I'm just wondering how...
Right now, we just all use root. And it would work right now, in fact, if you had a UID table consistent among all machines.
Okay.
How's that? So it uses the local file system and local permissions checking.
Right now it is.
And like I know, we like to use things like SSL and SSH. We'd really like to reuse existing technology as much as possible and do hooks for that.
Consider moving to something that uses
things like Kerberos type things? Or
whatever authentication method you want to use. It could be Kerberos.
We certainly looked at Kerberos. We decided a couple of months ago that you can really start working on security and never stop. That it just becomes a time sink, a black hole, where you just keep working on security and it never goes anywhere. So, and number two, we don't know anything about it. So we figured we'd let you send us security patches. I mean, we'll do something simple. We'll do something UID-based, maybe tie it in with SSH or something, do some rudimentary, reasonably secure things, because we like to assume that the network is insecure. But aside from that, I think we might have to bow down and let somebody a little bit more knowledgeable deal with that. So, thanks.
I had two questions. The first one is, I have said I laughed when I heard you were doing this in Perl, but I'm not laughing anymore. You talked about going through a transition of going from Perl to C at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect that you will get a lot of performance benefit out of that?
Maybe a bit. Perl really surprised me. That was, of course, one of my first objections. But Peter, it'll be slow. But it's not that bad. They've made a lot of engine changes in the last few years that have made it, you know, it's not your father's Perl. There's a lot of really great things. And so I'm not unhappy with it. We haven't done a lot of speed tuning yet either. We've been trying to get functionality going and things like that. But I expect there will be some. I mean, a not insignificant amount.
You expect to, in the transition from Perl to C, do it incrementally, so replace individual files with...
No, that won't fly.
Unfortunately,
it's really meant to be a self-contained unit. I mean, it's not... I have no idea how we would even think about making it call over to the Perl one and back and forth, and that would be a mess. I think we'd just sit down and spend 4 weeks and just do it. And I don't know how soon that'll be. I keep saying when we're happy with our feature set, which can end up being never. But he seems to want to do it pretty soon, and I think people want to give us money to do it, we'll do that too. I mean, if you want C version right now, you know, I can give you the name to make out the check to, and we're all done. Sort of depend on having a local file system for a cache. It's a really fundamental base of our file system that would be pretty hard to get around. If you wanted to, say, throw an extra half gig of memory in there and do a RAM disk, well, sure, that'd be great. If you wanted to just throw in a used 512 meg drive simply for use in caching, that would be great too. We would eventually like to have something almost like that, where you have maybe one local directory for /etc, and the rest you would just pop in a disk and boom, you have a client that's fully networked. That's our ideal goal, to be able to have setup like that where you can maintain the whole cluster from a single machine. That's our goal. But as far as fully diskless, I don't think so. Anything else? Fumin? Yes. Oh, yes. That's all on user level. And we've tried to keep the kernel code really, really simple. I don't think we've had an oops in months, literally. So almost all of the real functionality, all of the real intelligence, all of the semantics, with very little, very few exceptions, are all in user space. There is a device, Dev Presto, which is a character device, and we ship simple few byte commands up to the kernel. Like every 5 seconds or so right now, we ask the kernel to give me any journaled changes. Otherwise, you would wait until the whole page got full. And so if I touch a file and unplug my laptop, you know, I might never see that change until I filled up the whole rest of that page, which would be another 100 commands. And so that's poor. So we do things like down calls, which are just sending a few bytes to the kernel. And vice versa, when the kernel wants to give data to us, we always keep that pipe open. And so it can just simply shove things down that pipe.
So what it's doing here is trying to find out if that pipe is open.
It's trying to reconnect to the server, which is 1,000 miles away and disconnected. And so it, for testing, we have really short timeouts because it really, really sucks to sit there and test things and wait for 30 seconds every time. Oops, I fixed a small bug, go back and wait. Fix a small bug, go back and wait. That sucks. So we have it at like 3 seconds or 6 seconds or something. And so right now, yeah, it's just trying to reconnect, and then it gets a timeout and disconnects itself and tries again. So that's been going for 3 hours or so. Just in time for me to finish the course, in fact, which was really good, because I gave a presentation. And because it worked, we went ahead and did some quick benchmarks. And they're by no means scientific, but we found that we operated at about half local disk speed, which sort of makes sense because we have that context switch between Lento and the kernel. We operate about twice as fast as NFS at the time, and roughly 50 times faster than Coda or so. We didn't really have AFS available to test, and so we didn't do that. I mean, and I'm sure it's really not that bad as far as Coda, for example, I don't think is that bad anymore. There's been a lot of work, in fact, just in the last 6 months on fixing generic things that were just bottlenecks along the way. But it does show promise because of write-back caching and lazy reintegration for being really quite fast.
So you see this as being replacing for, instead of having NFS-mounted user directories, you can use this?
Precisely. That's exactly what it's for. And it's really a much better solution. I think NFS should have gone the way of, well, I guess NFS is sort of the first, so it should have gone away. It's a long time ago. Because it doesn't fix any of my needs. I can't use NFS here at all. And when I'm at home, I have different versions of files, and that doesn't help me, so it sucks. Basically the same code. There is very little code that is run by the server and not the client, and vice versa. We're talking maybe 40 lines. Plus the semantics. I mean, so 40 lines of the generic code and then some semantic stuff. The only real policy difference is the server does not trust clients. We assume, unlike a cluster file system, that the network is insecure. And so clients trust servers, but servers don't trust clients until they've authenticated and proved their worth. Furthermore, the server has the real copy. I mean, what's on their drive is gospel until they say otherwise, so they change it. And so when servers start up, they're allowed to clean their cache out, no problem. Or I'm sorry, when clients start out, they can clean their cache out. But if a server starts up and cleans its drive, all your files are gone. And so those type of policy changes are really the only difference. We hack for a week and we think, oh my god, this is excellent, it works so well. And then we find a subtle race condition, we can only duplicate 1 in 10 times. And so what we end up doing is we keep all of our state in memory, because right now it's not a huge amount, except when compared to things like NFS. So we intend to write things to disk like change logs. Because right now, if I changed some files in my Intermezzo drive and closed Lento, those changes would be lost. They would never get back to the server. So we want to save that state to disk. When we disconnect, we just make a little marker in the server record. This was the last file that I reintegrated. This was the last record. And then we just accumulate records from that point on. There is a lot of state, and for that reason, you can't just, like you can with NFS, for example, reboot your machine and just go. You would probably have to do a remount, or you would almost certainly have to do a remount if the server were rebooted. And there's no reason this couldn't be done in the background. I mean, we just haven't gotten to it yet. But it's something, I mean, we really do have to write all this state out to disk.
Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm solving some of these problems that Intermezzo is supposed to solve by using CVS to distribute the file system,
okay.
Which is good because I'm only using text files.
Okay, right.
So my question is, what kind of support does this or could this have for comment logging with the change logs?
Let's see here. Is your network fully connected, so everybody is all connected at once, and you don't take laptops off? Or?
Sometimes we take laptops off.
Okay. You're going to run into, like with CVS, a problem where if you disconnect your laptop and you change the change log, and then over on this machine it's still connected, you change the change log, and then you plug the laptop back in, you're going to get a conflict. And CVS is a little bit better at fixing conflicts because it has RCS to deal with, you know, sort of merging two files together. We don't do that. There have been times where CVS has done things that I don't really like, and so we give the user the choice. We have a set of hooks in our code so that you can tie in whatever conflict resolution you want. If you have a failover web server that has to stay current, then you could just say, keep the newest file, and then throw the other one away. If that's fine for your business, then do it that way. If you want a GNOME box that pops up and says, do you want me to run EDIF on these, and you can pick whichever you want, you can do that. It's totally up to the user, how they want to negotiate conflicts.
Yes. But when I change the local file mm-hmm. and have it sent back to the server, can I append a comment saying what I changed so that if another person
I see what you mean.
Gets that?
Not without your own set. I mean, in the end, this just deals with files. It doesn't deal with change comments or anything like that. So if you have your own scheme for managing those, yeah. I mean, I'm afraid this doesn't do anything more complicated than manage files, which in itself we found to be complicated enough. So,
if you're running NFS, I know that because it's stateless, you can have a whole lot of clients in the same server with really much overhead.
Mm-hmm.
How many clients could you connect yourself?
It's hard to say. We haven't really tried. I mean, we don't have enough machines, for example. We have people that want to try, and so we're all for letting them try. I don't think our overhead is big. It's hard to measure also with Perl because you're not really sure what it does with internal data structures and things. But just as a rough ballpark, I can't see us taking up more than, say, 10K per client after your initial startup. So you might have 4 megs on startup or whatever, but after that, you're probably only going to add 10, 20, 30K of client at the most. If you have a whole bunch of change logs on the server that are there to be given back to a client that is disconnected so it can't give them back, it will eventually cut them off and just say to the client when it reconnects, your file system is out of sync, you have to do a validate. Because we simply didn't have the resources to hold this huge log because you were disconnected for so long. So there's things like that. So we try to keep it reasonable. And I think, especially once we go to C, we can immediately see if we're doing things that could result in fewer resources used and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Does the server have to run on Linux with the kernel code, or could I run it on another?
Right now it requires Linux because we've only written that code. We've explored porting to NT, to Win98, to BSD, things like that. There's no reason it couldn't be ported to anything with a decent VFS layer. We do plan sometime in the next year or so to do an NT port, but it will almost certainly be a proprietary program, so I encourage you all to use Linux. And we might do a BSD port. It's hard to say. If somebody wants to do it, the kernel code's available. But right now, you only get Linux from us. Short term, we'd like to make it more robust. There are a couple of error conditions that we don't trap so nicely, a couple of really subtle issues that we don't deal with. And so over the next few weeks, we really just want to make it more stable, more usable. I use it at home now. I don't keep critical things without backups on it. But it helps me shake out the bugs that way. And for the most part, when I stay connected and even when I'm disconnected, it stays pretty sane. So we're really just going for more feature sets.
Right. The users of the mapping on the computer, so it would be totally insecure for me to use instrumental. And it would be hard for someone like me to add authentication inside the protocol, like when you mount a volume.
Not at all. The code, we've really tried to keep it simple. And I'm not sure exactly how you'd want to do what you wanted to do. But there's no reason. I mean, the code is really pretty self-explanatory. It's split out. It's commented even. There are pod docs spread throughout it. If you wanted to do authentication, the connection layer is nicely split out, so you can do authentication. It's easy to create new sessions and send different types of request packets. So there's no reason you couldn't add your authentication layer without too much trouble. It's a good question. I don't think it's altogether different. I don't know a lot about UserFS. I think I recall somebody at CMU bringing this point up, though, that it served almost exactly the same purpose, and the code was cleaner, something like that. It really is just a generic interface for making up calls into a user-level program. So it really is pretty much a generic wrapper around VFS calls. You could probably strip out things like journaling and just do more up calls and do them synchronously. I can't think of any real problems with that.
I know when I tried UserFS, the problem, the main problem with it was unreliable. Something went wrong in the user space and the kernel would start to
happen. No, this traps error codes and reports them nicely. And so.
You could build something like maybe an file system.
Yeah, I don't really see why not.